Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and my guest today is Gail S. Rosenteen, Ph.D. Gail, spelled G-A-Y-L-E, among its many variations, Gail. And Rosenteen is R-O-Z-A-N-T-I-N-E. Gail did a workshop last year that was very popular at our empathic therapy conference. And she'll be doing a plenary session, talking to the whole folks, at our upcoming conference. That conference, let me remind you, the best conference in its field by far and away, April 26th, 27th, and 28th, is going to be in Syracuse, New York this year. We'll probably move it the following year or two, but this year it's in Syracuse, New York. And we're going to have an interesting combination. We have got two of the top lawyers in the country in our field. Steve Scheller does these huge suits with the federal government that go after false practices by drug companies. Steve's a marvelous presenter, a marvelous person. Carl Protil, with whom I worked on malpractice cases, with deaths from suicides of children from the antidepressant drugs. He's a warm and caring man, really the best sort of lawyer to have in these tragic situations. We're going to have a judge from Florida who's going to talk about working with families and how to do it without pushing people into the psychiatric system and drugs. We're going to have Howie Glasser talking about his nurtured heart approach for an hour, and then he's going to do an evening film and workshop on Wednesday. On Sunday, we're going to have a panel where some folks who've never spoken in public before are going to talk about the death of their loved one who was a fine soldier and then a fine policeman who, under the influence of psychiatric drugs, took actions that were horrendous by his own standards and led him in despair to kill himself. And the family, mother and a wife, are going to speak for the first time. And as I'll tell you in a minute, Gail will be a very good person to be coming after them to talk about things. And I'm going to do a master therapy workshop with one of the finest men I've ever met, Bert Caron, who is, you know, he's been psychologist of the year and all sorts of things. And, it sounds pretty daunting, a master therapy workshop or whatever. We're going to talk about life and about helping people and being with people and about psychiatry and psychology. When we have talked in front of groups before, it's just nobody wants to stop talking with us. So we're going to set aside a good chunk of time for that. We're going to have a lot of positive and a lot of good critical stuff. Gail, I believe, is scheduled for Sunday to come after the panel, and she is a really good person to have to come after a panel about a man who was traumatized by war and had a traumatic reaction, which was reactivated as a police officer when he had to storm into a bar where they thought people were being held hostage and expected to have to be in a firefight. And It reactivated some of his worst experiences in Iraq. And so she's going to be a real good person to talk about that. Gail Rosenthal. Gail is a clinical psychologist. She's interested in a whole bunch of different things. But what's interesting about her is that she has really innovative and interesting approaches. She didn't just sit in an office like I do and talk. She's more imaginative than that. And she's the founder of the Center for Health and Well-Being in Savannah, Georgia. And she's in practice there with her husband, who's a psychiatrist, Barry Rosenthal. She's written a bunch of books, and the titles will tell you that she cares in particular about soldiers. One of her books is The Warrior's Workbook. Another is At Ease, Soldier: How to Leave the War Downrange and Feel at Home Again. Another is The Clinician's Guide to At Ease, Soldier. And another is The Wisdom of Wellness. She's got a lot of interesting approaches and projects that she can tell you best about. My friend Gail, are you there?
I'm here, and thank you for that very lovely introduction. I appreciate that a lot.
Well,
I admire your work and very much appreciate being a part of the radio show today. So thank you so much for inviting me.
You're so welcome, and you're going to be an important part of our conference. So tell us about your work or about anything you want to tell us about.
Well, it might be a good thing, since you've talked a bit about the presentation there at the conference, to start with the title of that and a little bit about what it will be about, because that gives a clue to the work that I do. The title of the workshop is A Clinician's Mission, Healing the Invisible Wounds of War. And that's what I've come to specialize in, particularly in the last decade or so. And in that presentation, I will be presenting the most recent statistics on a number of topics, which will include PTSD and depression, of course, because we're seeing such a high prevalence of that. Traumatic brain injury. I'll talk a bit about suicide. That's become quite a difficult problem within the military community. And then I'll talk more about the substance problems, domestic violence, child neglect, all the things that have been, increasing as a consequence of this long-term war that our soldiers have been involved in. Then I'll talk about the factors that contribute to it, whether it is the experiences that they have, their training, their stage of life. And I'll talk toward the end about the effective treatments for the treatment modalities that we find effective in working with our service members. So that addresses what I'll be talking about. And, of course, the title suggests that this is a passion for me that I have found at this stage of my life and being here in Savannah, Georgia, that since the onset of Operation Iraqi Freedom, that's when the soldiers in our area became involved in the global war on terror. So we've been working with them, my husband and I, for a good decade here, and we've seen the devastating effects that these war experiences, multiple deployments, insufficient dwell time. So all of those things are very, very close to our hearts.
Is there a big base there? There must be.
Yes, there is. There is the Fort Stewart Military Complex, and it is made up of a number of different units, most notably the 3rd Infantry Division. And they became very involved in the war in Iraq, as I said, in 2003. You have the Rangers that are special operations like the Navy SEALs. They've become even more active after some of the things that went on with the SEALs most recently. There are about 15 or so thousand soldiers on Fort Stewart, which is about 45 minutes from us. And then as a part of that complex, you have Hunter Army Airfield, which is a couple of miles from us. We are in the flight pattern. So on busy days, we get quite a bit of action over our building. There are about 4,000 to 5,000 people there, soldiers there. So you've got about 20,000 troops You've got dependents, civilian employees. So the bases altogether are about 55,000-57,000 people, you know, involved in this complex.
That is big. Well, go on and tell us some more about what you're doing.
Well, as I mentioned, I'll just sort of try to give a chronological explanation of that, about how things developed. My husband and I are I guess you'd call us the Vietnam generation. We trained with Vietnam veterans. I worked for six months in an inpatient rotation, a PTSD inpatient psychiatric wing of the VA hospital in training. So our hearts were already with military because we trained, you know, in the VA facilities. And then we opened a new facility here in December of 2002, and that's the one that people can see on the website with the koi ponds, the slate floors, the stained glass. You know, we've done everything that we could to make it a very comfortable place for anyone who came to see us. Well, that was December of 2002, and OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, started in March of 2003. So that first deployment was extremely harsh. The troops were deployed. The war conditions were very harsh. They were deployed for 15 to 18 months. There was limited communication. And the way it all started for us is we began to see the dependents. Now, I see adults primarily, some adolescents. My husband sees people of all ages. So what we started to see was the dependents coming in. They weren't hearing from their husbands. They were frightened. Many of the young ones, they married at 18, 19. The husbands went off in a few months. They had moved away from home. They had no support. And they were really suffering, these young women who had never been exposed to anything of this nature. What Barry began to see is also young women, but they were the ones, he actually sees children, and so he was seeing children coming in with the parents who were very anxious, and, you know, the parenting in some of the individuals was not so strong because they were under a lot of pressure. So we were working initially with the dependents. So as the time went on and we helped to support these young women and their families, we really expected when their husbands came back in 15, 18 months, depending on the unit, that we would see things get better. But actually what we saw was the first results of the men and women who were deployed living in a combat zone. And like I said, it was very harsh. There were a lot of losses, a great deal of PTSD that has come out of the initial, the very beginning of that conflict. So what happened is we began then to see, or I began to see couples coming in. Not only was I seeing the young women, but they were bringing their soldiers in. So that was the first exposure to the troops, you know, when they had come back and they were having difficulty with substance abuse, some domestic violence. The men were very shut down. They were quite traumatized. And so I would work with the couples and work, you know, for a period of time. Now, what was going on at that point, Peter, is that our, I guess you'd say the government or the military, did not realize what it would be like for these young people to be deployed for 15, 18 months, be home for a year, and deploy again. So they went back off after being home a year, just beginning to get accustomed to being together again. Then they had to say goodbye again. So off the soldiers go, back to Iraq. They're gone another year. The communication was a little bit better. We were beginning to, you know, they were beginning to be able to communicate by internet and so forth. They were gone another year. Then they came back. They were home another year. Then they went for a third deployment. And they were gone another year. So some of them were going back for the stabilization of Iraq. Others were beginning to go into Afghanistan. And so what happened eventually after three deployments that we were seeing this, the devastating effects, is that somebody realized that they needed more dwell time. It's called dwell time. And so after the third deployment, the men and women who were, you know, the soldiers, had a two-year window to stay at home. And many of them left in around September or so of last year for a fourth deployment. They're in Afghanistan now. We're not in Iraq at all. They're losing a lot of, you know, there's a lot of internal kind of being able to tell if the locals are going to turn on them. So they're under a lot of pressure right now. This is supposed to be a nine-month deployment. They should be coming back in July, about around July, August. It remains to be seen. But that's basically what we've seen. Every time a soldier goes, they come back different. And while they've been in the world of war, suffering from what you would call, I call in my book, Eddie Soldier, collateral damage, which is the war in the mind, they come home to families that have now, on the home front, learned how to be independent, take control, even if they're young women. And so then they come in and they have this real battle of, you know, power struggles and so forth. So it's been extremely, extremely difficult. In 2011, 30,000 divorces, which was an increase, a considerable increase. So that's basically what we've seen, and we've come to more and more to value these young people because they are courageous. When they signed in, they believed that they were, you know, signing in and signing up to go protect our freedom, and that's what they do. They put their life on the line, and they really have suffered the impact over this decade in this area.
It's very graphic, your description of what they go through. I've never had it simply laid out like that. I mean, how does anybody survive?
Well, you know, it's a part of their training. And as I mentioned in the book, Eddie Soldier, and I'll take a moment, if I may, to describe how that evolved, if that's all right with you.
Yeah.
After, you know, beginning the work in 2003, and seeing the difficulty that our military community was suffering, it happened that in 2009, Barry and I were invited to a meeting over at Hunter Army Airfield, and Major General Anthony Cucullo, was the commander of the 3rd ID at that time. And he and others had a several hours of meetings with all of us to explain, of those of us in the field, that that they expected at that point in February of 2009 for the conflicts in the area to continue for a considerable amount of time. Well, that was alarming to me because we had already seen close to 6 years of war and already, you know, multiple deployment and difficulty. And so what happened is I became very concerned about it, and I started reviewing and researching what had been done in terms of what do we know about modern combat training. We know what the consequences of Vietnam, but what about now? And so what I did was to begin to research that, and I found a lot of material that had been compiled and published through from Walter Reed Army Hospital. There's a Charles Hogue, a Colonel Hogue, he's retired now, and I believe he's a Colonel Castro, and they did a great deal of research on the impact of the combat training and combat experiences on those soldiers coming back. And so what they did was they identified 10 basic skills that they used the acronym Battle Mind, and they've changed that from Battle Mind to Resiliency Training. But what they called the training that they were giving these soldiers was Battle Mind Training. And those 10 skills made these soldiers excellent soldiers. They made them, you know, able to survive, to protect themselves and their buddies. But every one of the skills created a problem at home, interpersonally with family, with friends, and so forth. And so what I did was, in researching, I began to put the materials together, and that was the Warrior's Workbook. And what I did with the Warrior's Workbook is I compiled the materials, and I was producing them here, giving them to my soldiers, asking them, you know, to use them and to let me know, you know, what, was it helpful? And I had one particular, this particular veteran was a Vietnam veteran. And when he came to see my husband and myself, he had been a Navy SEAL. He had joined at age 19. That was the first time he killed anyone, was at 19. He served for over 30 years, highly decorated, and he was still suffering from very debilitating post-traumatic stress disorder. And he was coming in to see me every week. He was seeing my husband as well. And I gave him the workbook, and he started using it. And he came in, and he said, "Dr. Gale, this material is changing my life." He said, because what it was I would give him material, and then I had a space for him to write. And what he did was he scanned it in his computer, and he started using it. And every week he'd come in, he said, "Oh, the nightmares are changing. I'm not having, you know, the person might be there, but it's not the same." And so what happened is he kept saying, "You must do something with this material. I don't want to see another generation like my generation. You have to do something, Dr. Gale." So I, you know, thought about it and waited for a while and, you know, just got other feedback from the soldiers who were coming in and their spouses. I would let them have a look at it, too. So by 2010, he was becoming quite insistent. "You must do something, Dr. Gale." So I said, "Well, I know that this material is probably not going to be something that a standard publishing company would be interested in. So I'm going to sit down." And what I did was, in early 2010, I think it was right around January, February of 2010, I sat down with the materials that I had compiled. And I can't exactly explain what happened, Peter, but the book sort of wrote itself. It was not written like a psychologist would write it. It was written in what I would call soldier speak. It's brief sentences. It's, you know, it's to the point. It's not a lot of text, but it spoke to the various things that these soldiers were going through. And so what I did was I gave a little beginning, a little thing at the beginning, a little chapter called Collateral Damage, after I'd done the introduction. And in the introduction, I said, "You got a lot of junk in your truck. This book is going to help you unload the junk." The Collateral Damage is a series of questions, and the soldiers look through it and they go, "Yes, that's me, that's me, that's me," because those are they're these various areas that they have problems in. And then the next little chapter was about the sights, sounds, and smells of war. I didn't want to give too much, just enough to let them know that I sort of knew what I was talking about, because here I had been working with these soldiers. I was hearing what was going on, what it was like to be the target of hostility, what it was like to be afraid, what it was like to be lonely. And what I did was I wrote the text out. The next chapter was what I call Battle Mind Debriefing. And in it, each one of those areas I was talking about, the skills and the problems, had what I would call a mini chapter. Then I did a chapter on sleep, one on stress management, and the one on sleep I called Soldier's Snooze Blues, tried to make it appealing. Then one on stress management, then a short chapter on anger management, which is huge, and we call that rage gauge. And then there was a short chapter on alcohol, the alcohol alert, and then a conclusion. So all throughout, I wanted them to have room to write. What happened is I found a young graphic designer. There's a large art school here called Savannah College of Art and Design. And I found this young woman. I looked at her portfolio, and I said, "I like it. She looks creative." And I turned my text over to her, and I had used clip art to sort of illustrate so she could get an idea of what I had in mind. She took my text and spent months selecting, and I would run these ideas by my soldiers. I'm like, does this look good to you? And they'd say, I like that, but I don't like that. So it became this effort that all of us had together, because these materials were helping them, and they wanted to be a part of the creation of something that would help other soldiers. So by early 2011, my publication date was the 8th anniversary of the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom. I published the book, and what's happened, Peter, and this is, I've got to tell you, it's heartwarming. And I just had a young man in yesterday. These guys, these are big guys. They're 6'3". Yes.
The Warrior's Workbook, is that the book you're describing?
This is Eddie Soldier. Now
this
it's Eddie
Soldier. Sorry, I wanted to get that clear. Right. Eddie Soldier. Okay.
Right. This is the Eddie Soldier. I give them to every one of my soldiers, and I've, you know, they're being used right now in hospitals called the Patriot Support Programs by Universal Health Service Services. So they're being used by the hundreds to help these soldiers. But
that's
I had a young man in yesterday, and he looked at me and he said, because I told him I was going to be presenting, I let my soldiers know. He said, you have to tell them, Doc. He said, you have to tell them to listen. He said, they have to listen and let us know they care. He said, when I saw your book and I took this book home and I read this book, I knew you care, and that's why I can tell you the things that happened to me in Iraq. He said, I could talk to a soldier about it, but most of them don't. They keep it quiet. But he says, I know I can tell you because I know you understand me and I know you care. And that makes it all worthwhile, Peter. That makes it all worthwhile.
Can you, I think your work is marvelous.
Thank you.
Tell me, do you have at your fingertips a little bit about battle mind? What are the principles of battle mind, and how do they then get become incompatible with civilian life?
Yes, I absolutely do. And this will be a major part of what I'm presenting to, you know, to the clinicians who come to my presentation. But what happens is this.
By the way, I want to say, you know this, but I want the folks to know it's not just clinicians who will be at the conference, third Empathic Therapy Conference, April 26th through 28th in Syracuse. By the way, you get to that through empathictherapy.org, or you can get to it through Breggin.com, Breggin.com, or just go right to empathictherapy.org. And, of course, there will be families there. There will be people who have been victimized and injured by psychiatry, and there will be a lot of clinicians, too. But it's quite a lovely mix of people from across the board. But I think it would be useful for people to hear a few specifics about the kind of a principle a soldier's taught to live by while he's in combat, or she,
right,
and then what in the world happens. And another thing it might be fun, interesting to get into, it's going to say fun, but it's not exactly fun, is to get into is women in war and in the combat zone. Now, we've got only about 2 minutes right now before we go to break, so maybe give us an example of battle mind principle that doesn't work when you're...
All right. So, the battle mind training is to increase the soldier's self-confidence. All right. And if you would like, I can go through each one of the skills and explain.
Just take one to start with, and we'll have a conversation. Right now, we've only got 1 minute. So why don't we take a breather, and we'll do that. We'll come back and talk about battle mind. Right now, tell folks how they can get in touch with you in Savannah, Georgia, and how they can get your book.
All right. We have several websites. The one for soldiers, the one where people can see, and even examples of the book, some pages from the book, that is www.soldiersathome.com, soldiersathome.com. And they get a good description and some testimonials and so forth. Another way is to go to www.quietawakening.com. If a person puts me in the Google search, you're going to have a few pages. So it will bring, if you put Gail Rosantin, PhD, it will bring up the Center for Health and Well-Being, and that's the Quiet Awakening. We also have one called MyOptimaVita.com. That's the publishing company that I created to publish the books. So those three websites will give you contact information.
My guest, Gail Rosantine, R-O-Z-A-N-T-I-N-E, really informative, and we will be back to talk about battle mind, what it is, and how soldiers have to recover from it. And this is Dr. Peter Gregan with my guest, Gail Rosantine, R-O-Z-A-N-T-I-N-E. I'd like to just think of a few things we might cover in the next half hour. And one of them is the training the soldiers get, battle mind, and how it affects them, and what it means for returning home. I think another interesting subject, if Gail has seen enough women coming back from combat, and yet another interesting subject is kind of the setting that Gail works in, has created, which involves kind of de-stressing rooms. I forget what she calls them, but she's got some really interesting and innovative ways. And as I sit in my office, which is a home-like, the only thing unusual about my office is it's very home-like, very pleasant, and the dogs visit and things like that. But she goes a lot further than that in providing services that, you know, maybe uniquely tailored to soldiers who've been through trauma, but I think they'd be good for anybody. So, Gail, some of the subjects I want to talk about with you. And also, you know, what is the post-traumatic experience like? So some thoughts for you to
sure.
go with.
Well, where would you like to start? Do you want to start with battle mind? Do you want me to talk a little bit about
that? Let's talk
okay, the battle
about
mind.
That.
I'll go through it as quickly as I can so that people
no,
get
no,
a sense.
Take your time and pick one or two things.
Right.
We don't want to survey so much on our show. Is just pick one or two interesting aspects and talk about it.
All right. I think the two that probably are most pertinent that cause the biggest problems. You see, the Battle of Mind acronym stands for a word, and then that's what, you know, so B is buddies. Now, what it means by buddies is that the training creates a cohesion within the members of the unit. In other words, when you really think about being in combat, it's truly the members of a unit become a family that is almost stronger than a biological and marital bonds, because they truly are watching each other's back. They will do anything for their buddies. And so it's wonderful that they are there to protect each other's back. But the problem is when they get back home, because now they're a band of brothers, sisters too, but when they get back home, they want to be with people who've been there and done that. And so when they get back home with their families, after the first couple of weeks, you know, that's sort of the honeymoon period, but they want to be with their buddies. So when instead of going to be with family or spending time with family, they have this pull to be with their buddies. And you can imagine for a young woman who's been away from her, you know, her husband's been away, or the vice versa, if it was the wife gone, they want to be with that spouse. They don't understand. You want to be with your buddies? You were with them for a year, 15 months, 18 months. Now be with me. But it's a cohesion that then causes that soldier to either want to be with that buddy or to be alone. They are easily overwhelmed by the demands of family. So the battle mind buddy skill, so to speak, becomes withdrawal, and you can see how that would create interpersonal problems. Now, another problem that you have is controlling behavior. In other words, soldiers have to be accountable. They have to know where their weapons are. They have to be accountable for all their gear. If they have been promoted to a sergeant, then they are in charge of the people beneath them, or, you know, in their unit who are accountable to them. So they become very controlled. They are all part of a unit that works together, and they control it. You know, their environment is, or they can't control their environment, so they control everything that they can. Well, you can imagine they come home. They're used to being in control. Their wife has now been used to being in control on the home front. Now you've got each one trying to be controlling of the other, and that doesn't work. So you've got controlling. The other thing, let me just mention a couple of other ones, because they're
all important. You're doing really good, and take your time with it. This is worth mulling on.
Okay. Another one is targeted aggression. In other words, that's a T. Targeted aggression means if I need to protect myself or my buddies, I can do it, and I know how to do it. But when a person comes back from being in a war zone where they have had to use targeted aggression, they can go from zero to a fist fight in about a second. They are trained killers, every one of them, and they could do it. And some of them, you know, some of them are like gentle giants. I mean, they come in here, they're big old guys, 6'2", 3'4", you know, a couple hundred, 225, 250 pounds. Sometimes they'll sit with me because the anger comes up so fast. And, they'll sit with me and say, I have to really walk away because I could snap that person's neck in a second. And I don't, and they're gentle giants, but it bothers them that they feel angry so easily. So anger is a huge issue among our troops. That's a part of what I work on with the stress management, helping them to learn to use the breath and to let things go. So one thing that most of us civilians would never think of. Now, you know, we may get impatient in our car if we're stuck in traffic or whatnot. But if you have been a soldier in a convoy and you have been in a Humvee and you have been in harm's way where if you go slowly, you can be killed, or you've lost a buddy and the Humvee in front of you got blown up, vehicle has an entirely different meaning. If you did that for several years over 3 or 4 deployments, can you imagine what it's like to be sitting in traffic or to come to a red light? They feel like they're getting gridlocked. And one of the things that I will encourage people to do is go look, if you really want to know what your soldiers are going through, go look on YouTube and put driving in Baghdad. And you'll be in a Humvee, and you'll be going along. This is in my clinician's guide for those who are working with soldiers. They absolutely must understand some of what our soldiers have been through to get the rage, the road rage that they feel. But a soldier in a Humvee can bump a car in front of them. They can run them off the road. They can fire their guns to make them get out of the way. They can shoot their vehicles. They can do anything they want to do to go fast. And we don't realize what they're going through. Imagine. So around here, with all the soldiers around here, you have people coming in, and they're sometimes just white-faced. They're like, oh, my gosh, it was terrible on 516 today, which is what goes, it's the road that goes next to Hunter. All these trucks going fast. It's a function of having been in vehicles in harm's way and having gone through, some of them, some very terrible things. So those are some of the things. I could go on because there's more. But that's some of what the skills.
Yeah. Take a few more of the acronym for Battle Mind and talk about it. This is all I think is extremely interesting. And, I mean, you bring such a combination of empathy, experience, and understanding together. It's quite remarkable. So I think this is a nice format for you to proceed with if you want to tell us a little more.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank you for the compliments. This is the function of having been with these soldiers. Now, I realize they're not my children. You know, I have children who are the same ages and older. But to me, that's part of the empathy. I want to help you. I want to help you get back to as normal as you can be. So I wanted to learn from them. Every time they share with me, I learn something. Another part of the acronym is T, is tactical awareness. That means if I have to be hypervigilant. If I'm in harm's way and I'm in the combat zone, I have to know everything that's going on. I'm watching my back. I'm watching my soldiers' back. I know everything around me. Now, if you do that for months on end or years in multiple deployment, when you come back, how comfortable are you in a crowd? How comfortable are you in a complex like where we have our buildings? How comfortable are you? You can't see around that building over there, so you don't know what's coming around the building. The feeling that something bad is going to happen now is with them for months and years of being deployed. So tactical awareness turns into what we call hypervigilance. So they're watching their backs all the time. So we've done B, accountability, 2 T's, L, locked and loaded. Okay, when you're in a combat zone, you have your weapon with you all the time. So guess what? Come back to the States, you want a weapon with you in your truck. You want it on your, you know, under your pants. Okay, in some states, it's not okay to carry a weapon on your person. So locked and loaded becomes lethally armed when you come back home. So there's another one. Another is the E, is emotional control. A soldier becomes very controlled of emotions. They absolutely dissociate their emotions in order to do what they have to do, because if they're going to have to kill someone, particularly if it's a woman or child, their emotions have to be totally put aside. And so what can happen is they practice that for so long that when they get back home and their wife is tearful or their girlfriend is having a meltdown, they either become detached, shut down, and the brain goes into that over-regulating the limbic system, so they shut down, or they feel very angry at the emotions of other people. So that's the E of the battle. Now, the mind part is M, is mission OPSEC, which becomes secretiveness, okay? Mission OPSEC is operation security, okay? That's the OPSEC, okay? So when
I'm not following that. Mission,
okay,
what is that word?
It's called mission OPSEC, 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 operation
mission
security.
OPSEC.
Mission OPSEC, okay, and that's in the book. Mission OPSEC, which is Operation Security. What it turns into is secretiveness when they get back home, because when you're in the military, you can't talk to anyone about a mission because you could cause the mission to, you know, you can't tell anybody except your buddies. You're all in that, doing that mission together. So when they come back, they're afraid to talk about what happened. They're afraid it will hurt the people who are still over there. And so they keep a lot inside and learn to be secretive. Well, now some spouses don't want to hear, oh no, that's way too much for me, I can't stand it. But many spouses want to hear, tell me, what's going on? But the soldiers are so accustomed to being controlled and to being secretive that it's difficult for them to open up. That's one of the benefits that I've certainly experienced here, because I've written the book. They know I get it. You know, they can tell me anything, and it's confidential. So, but soldiers really struggle with that. So that's the mission. That's the M part. Okay. I, in Battle Mind, is individual responsibility guilt. That means I've got responsibility for me and my buddy when I'm a soldier. If I didn't protect my buddy and my buddy died, then I feel guilty. Survivor's guilt. I should have done that. And they replay it. They go back and back and back. those who've been through these losses of buddies, it haunts them that they weren't able. And so many of them will go back to, and this is something that I do with them in session, is let's go back to before the loss. Let's talk about what was it like? What were those memories? Tell me, share that with me. What could you have done differently? Okay, well, let's replay that, but realizing that there was really nothing you could do to stop that RPG from hitting or that IED from blowing your buddy up. There was really nothing you could do. They struggle with the guilt of having the responsibility for their buddies. So that's the I. Okay? So, and I've already discussed, this one is... it's a non-aggressive driving, the combat driving that becomes aggressive driving. We talked about that earlier. And then the last of the acronym is D, and that is discipline. In other words, they're very disciplined. And if they're sergeants and they tell other people what to do, they're used to, you know, talking to one another as if they're ordering. So when they come home, they try to order their family around, and that doesn't work. So those are the basic. Those are the basics. Those are the 10 skills and the problems. That's the Battle Mind acronym.
When these, it's such important information. When these soldiers are home for 1 year, 2 years, what are they doing? What is their task or job in life?
Well, this is part of the problem, too, is depending, and by the way, one of the things that I haven't mentioned a lot of is the special ops. These are the Rangers. These are the ones that do the SEALs jobs. So they're the ones that take the, you know, do the really the very targeted work. They're gone for 3 months, home for six. And so they have the shorter deployments. But what happens, Peter, is that when they come home, first they have a honeymoon period. Then they start, you know, trying to make an adjustment. And in my clinician's guide, I outline these seven stages of deployment, which I won't go through now, but they're actual stages that people go through when they're preparing for deployment.
I was actually asking a simpler question.
Okay.
What are their assigned tasks?
Right.
When they're off for a year, they're not just ordered to stay at home, are they?
Well, no. What most of them
do, they have a job to do of some sort.
What they have a job to do, but this, okay, there are two things that, in a sense, create problems. When they are over there, they are working, the first 3 months, they are working 16, 18-hour days, and that is literally true. They are getting practically no sleep. They don't even know what day it is. Even after they get through the first 3 months, they are working 12, 14, 16-hour days. 14-hour days are usual. They are working all the time, so they are on. When they get back here, often they're sort of sitting doing nothing, and they are bored stiff. Or the other thing that they're doing, particularly as they prepare to deploy again, is they're gone for weeks at a time for training. So they're either here, and some of them talk about being bored. You know, every one of them has to get up and do PT unless they've been injured and they've got problems, you know, from injuries. And some of the injuries come from carrying 87 to 127 pounds of combat gear. That's the average load for the foot soldier, if you can imagine it. So that, you know, injures their knees and their feet. But they do PT, and then depending on what their unit does, the ones that are close to us here at Hunter, they repair, you know, they're mechanics, they work on the aircraft, some of them are pilots. You know, so they do their trainings and so forth. Some of them get very bored, and that's part of what they complain about, is I feel useless when I'm here. Now, they're doing training, I'm sure the infantry, and they go into the, you know, to the shooting range and so forth. But, no, they don't stay at home. They report for work, and then they're assigned whatever they do. Is that clear?
Yeah, that's what I wanted folks to, because I actually didn't know exactly. So they're going to have various duties, but a lot of it's going to be some of it will be training, and so they will be with their buddies to some degree, but not the same ones, or will they?
Sometimes. It depends. Sometimes, and this is one of the things that people don't realize, that soldiers, you know, some of them return, and they are given what they call a permanent change of station, so they PCS. So they come home, and depending on what their orders are or where they are in terms of their career, some come back here and stay. Others are PCS'd to a different installation. Now, the problem for some is that they PCS to a unit that is getting ready to deploy again. They don't even get a year. I had one young man, and you will find this difficult to believe, and this was probably the most severe case of PTSD I've ever seen. In 17 years of service, he had been in combat for 11 years because he would go in combat. He would come home. He would PCS to a different route, unit that was getting ready to deploy again. He'd go back over for a year, come back. He'd get PCS. It was an amazing story. So it depends, you know, on whether they are transferred, so to speak, as to whether they are going to do, you know, work here or someplace else. It depends on their MOS, which is what they're assigned to do. That's what they do for their job, with a mechanic or a medic or something like that.
One of the things I hear about the Army is what a huge bureaucracy it is.
Yes.
And I guess things just happen to people that aren't supposed to happen and that they can't really change or may not want to change.
Right.
It must be out of their control a fair amount or entirely nearly.
It is. They do what they're told. They are ordered, and that's probably part of the reason some of them are so controlling, is they can try to control the home front when they're home, but they're very much, you know, they're very much disciplined to do what they're told to do.
How did the male soldiers feel about working with you? People can't see you, obviously, on the radio. Gail is a very fine-looking, very attractive-looking, very Southern. Is that a fair thing to say about you? You look
like
the
best. I guess it is. The Southern part, anyway.
Southern woman could be. I mean, is that fair?
I missed the last thing you said. What did you say, Peter?
You're sort of like the best a Southern woman is supposed to look.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You know, this has not been a problem.
You're not insulted by that.
You know, if not at all, because
I mean it very affectionately,
right,
and respectfully. How do these 220-pound roughnecks from the hills of Virginia or West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee relate to you?
There is something I think about when they come into our office and they see the surrounding. It's calm. And as you mentioned earlier, I do something quite innovative. Everyone gets stress management training in a special room. And, you know, I explain to everyone who comes that, you know, I'm here to serve you and we work together to facilitate your healing. But with these soldiers, from the very beginning, well, in the first place, my husband and I are known for our commitment to soldiers. So they've heard a lot about us from on post and, I guess, talking to one another. But their sense, I think, when they come in is a sense of relief. And I make it very clear from the first time I meet them, and, you know, at the very beginning of my intake, I want to thank you for your service. I can't thank you enough for what you have sacrificed to protect my freedom and to ensure the safety of my family. So it's a privilege to serve you. And that's the first thing I let them know. And whether it is age, whether it is color, it never seems to matter. Because I have had these young people sitting, these big guys, with tears streaming. They just feel like they can open up. And I can't explain it other than to say that my intention is to serve them and to do whatever I can do to help them to feel as normal as they can again and to feel understood. So it's never been a problem. It has never been a problem. So thank you for the compliments. But, you know, I let them know. I love them. You know, I love them.
I want people listening to this to realize whatever your work is, whether you're a physician or a teacher or a therapist or a lawyer or a waitress or the manager of a restaurant, whatever it is, that if you think about yourself the way Gail is thinking about herself, that you're there to serve people, to bring your full self, your knowledge, your skills, your ability, to help the people, to serve the people who are coming to you, you are going to do a lot of good in this universe, and you're going to really, believe it or not, love what you do, because it's going to be so clear to you that you're there for the other person and not for yourself. And you're just going to help folks by the very approach that you take. So, Gail's using the serve, the Army model of we serve. And believe me, this is what many of our soldiers feel, that they are there to serve. That's what they're taught. They're there to serve. And they're there to serve the Constitution, and they're there to serve the country, and they're there to protect. And if you approach human beings in this manner, you're going to have a good life. Whatever you do, whether you're a farmer making vegetables for folks or growing vegetables, whatever it is you're doing, if you're thinking this way, you're going to have a good life. And Gail, you're a wonderful model for that.
Well, thank you.
We have about a minute left, by the way, Gail. We got about probably a minute left.
Oh.
When you hear the music, wow, there's the music.
There's the music.
Let me thank Gail S. Rosentine for being with us. Rosentine. Come hear her and meet this marvelous woman at our conference, April 26th through 28th in Syracuse this coming month.
Thank you so much, Peter. This has just been delightful talking with you.
Yeah,
thank you so
wonderful.
Much for the opportunity.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.